This is Mags Hall. Fasten your seatbelts. I'm going to take you on a trip into the blogosphere. It may seem all doom and gloom in the UK with many music titles folding. Melody Maker, The Face, Sleaze Nation, Music and Seven magazine are just some of the victims affected by the recent decline in sales of British music magazines, which have left the shelves of Smith's emptier than the last night bus home from Catford. Far from being stagnant though, many music hacks and bedroom critics have taken things into their own hands. Music blogs are a growing internet phenomena, a space on the ether where music lovers exchange their ideas free from editorial constraints. Mark Fisher, who writes under the name K-Punk, gave me the lowdown on the blogging phenomena.
Some blogs are substitute journalism, giving very detailed reviews. Others are more like diaries, personal subjective accounts. Others are more like chat rooms, where there's lots of conversations going on. I think mine is in between those three, really. I guess that's one of the things about blogging, that you get the opportunity to completely let loose. And there's no editorial control. There's no brand identity you have to protect or something like that. You can say what you think, really. That's the benefit of it. What's unfamiliar about it is the kind of speed of feedback. You're much more aware of having an audience. If you write for publication, it can feel like it's going into a void. Whereas with a blog, you're very aware that people are reading it. Particularly at a time when the music press is in quite serious decline in this country. I mean, there isn't really one in lots of ways. The collapse of Melody Maker, with NME now being like smash hits for students, really. It's completely unchallenging repertoire of about four or five bands it seems to cover every time I look at it. There isn't any other forum anyway. There isn't any forum to either read or participate in. The opportunity to, you know, engage in conversations with people like Simon Reynolds on an equal playing field is a real attraction. And that is one of the great things about blogging, that more or less when anyone can participate in it, and if they've got something worthwhile to say, it's interesting, they'll get sort of drawn into the network, really, and then will gain readership.
Music bloggers come in all shapes and sizes, but it may come as no surprise they're mostly male shape. However, one of the few exceptions is journalist Geeta Dayal.
My name's Geeta Dayal, and the name of my blog is The Original Soundtrack. Well, I started The Original Soundtrack as a zine in 1998, and I had a whole staff of contributors, and we made like a 20 or 30 page zine, and I always wanted to start the zine back up, and then never really had the time. And then when I started writing, I'm a writer in New York, I just didn't have the time to start like a big magazine of my own. And so when this blogging thing started becoming really popular, I thought, why not just make it a blog? It's much easier to update a blog just by yourself than have to deal with a staff of 15 people. Blogging has been around for quite a long time. It's only been recently, though, where it's really hit a fever pitch. I think a lot of this has to do with, from a technology standpoint, it becoming so much easier to make a blog now. You have Blogger, and if you have all of this easily available free software, you know, anybody can start a blog in 10 minutes, which is great. I mean, it also means that, you know, if anybody can start a blog, it means that you're suddenly clogged with millions of blogs, you know, many of which are totally useless and are just like, well, today I went to the shop and I bought, you know, something to drink, and then I went home, and it was just really awful and mundane and boring. Or you get like the sort of aggressively personal blogs, which I don't really pay attention to, you know, like the sort of live journal types of things, which are more aimed towards sort of airing out your personal laundry in public, it seems. You know, I'm not really into that, but what I'm into is more is the potential for great journalism to come out of blogging. One of the great things about blogging is to get more comfortable with your writing and to get more comfortable with your voice and your style, and to not worry so much about things and not have to worry that an editor's watching you. And I really look forward to writing on my blog, because that's where I get to just be myself and be crazy and silly and if I feel like it.
Music writer Simon Reynolds has quickly become a convert. His own Bliss blog is one of the most popular sites on the web.
I became aware of this world through this thing, New York, London, Paris, Munich, which is not really a blog as such, but more like a forum or message board sort of run by a collective of people started by this guy, Tom Ewing. And then its sort of sister organisation is I Love Music, which is again a forum where people set up topics and long threads develop discussing them. They can be quite sort of argumentative and bitchy, or they can be very informed and interesting, or just, you know, very heated and exciting. And then there's a sort of, then I became aware of this constellation of blogs attached to the I Love Music and New York, London, Paris, Munich area. And these were blogs like Sky Kicking, done by this guy in Australia called Tim Finney, The Church of Me by Marcello Carlin, Technicolor by a guy called Jess Harville, and a bunch of others. And I just felt like I wanted to participate. It was almost like an act of intellectual hygiene as well, because I was doing this book and I had loads of ideas about current music, but I was too busy to actually do them as journalism. So I just thought I would mouth off on them. And what I liked about the blogs was that you could throw out half-formed ideas, or like just almost like kind of one-liners, weird idiosyncratic thoughts that didn't really have a context in journalism. I mean, another thing that's interesting about blogs, I think, is that they respond to the way music is now, which is that, you know, whereas magazines are all tied around release schedules and what's out this month, the way people actually consume music is totally anachronistic, in the sense that you might be as excited by a record from 1974 that you'd found in a secondhand record store as you are about something that, you know, some grime dub plate that's only just being played on the Pirates or whatever. So I like that aspect, that you can sort of skip around through time. It just sort of liberates you from all those strictures. So I wanted to get, you know, I just wanted to join in, really. I join in the fun.
Matthew Ingram created Wobot.com to channel his unabated music addiction.
I guess I was quite a kind of obsessive music fan for years and years. And I never really had an outlet for my passions. So I would spend a lot of time, for instance, bugging my assumed mentor, Simon Reynolds, with emails, and you know, generally feeling kind of nutty and isolated, because that's the situation when you fall quite deeply into music. You become quite isolated, and because you find these strange things that nobody knows what they are, or very few people know what they are. And so anyway, the weblog was basically has enabled me to sort of share with what is essentially a small audience, but it's an audience that is stretched across the world. My site is relatively new, and I guess the phenomenon, if it's such a thing, is pretty new. But, you know, one of the original music blogs is about 4 years old. I think he's just finished it, a guy called Josh Blog. He did a music blog, which is very old. But I think, in fact, weblogs more generally have been around for quite a long time, but the blogger technology meant that it was a lot easier for people to do. You didn't have to know how to edit HTML code, and you didn't have to know how to set up an FTP client and all that sort of thing. You could just do it on a proprietary website. So that made it a lot easier for a lot more people to start doing it. What really drove me into it was not just the connection with Reynolds, but that made it, you know, easier, but just because I had a lot to get off my chest in terms of the music that I was into. And in fact, a lot of the bloggers have got kind of roots in fanzines. You know, John at Uncarved, he ran a fanzine. You know, I used to hand lots stapled out comics around record stores. The only difference is that those same nutters are actually have got access to the internet, and you know, you can reach anybody. So instead of, you know, reaching 50 people, you're reaching thousands. It's amazing the amount of people who could go to these blogs. Once I got 1,000 downloads of a mix in one day. You know, quite routinely across my whole site, I'll get 20 or 30,000 hits across the whole site in a day. And I'll get, just on the front page every day, regularly, I'll get 600 hits a day. He's just a rascal, he's just a rascal, he's just a rascal,
he's a rascal, he's just a rascal. Initially, Luke Herrenbone was on a mission to spread grime to the masses.
I started it because there was a new type of music just coming out, just starting, and now they're calling it grime. But back then, they didn't really have any type of name for it at all. The records were just sort of seeping into the shops at about that time, and Simon Reynolds had sort of talked a little bit about it, but obviously he lives in New York and he can't really talk about it in great detail. He couldn't hear it on a day-to-day basis. So I just really wanted to spread information about that type of music because I thought that that was the most exciting thing that had happened since probably, well, for 10 years, basically. The most exciting music that happened for 10 years. And nobody hardly knew about it outside of East London, which was a big shame and a travesty, and I thought that everybody should hear it, so I just wanted to put that information out quickly, and I thought that that was the best way to do it. And no one was covering it, loads of people knew about it, but they were the wrong sort of people. They weren't the North London media buds, and that's all there is to it. Those people didn't want to know because they're always 10 years behind. All I wanted to do was spread the word. I didn't ever want to be a music journalist or nothing. I wanted people to know about that, and now they know, so I don't even hardly have to talk about it anymore, really. People are talking about it now, and Dizzy Rascal got in The Guardian.
Definitely I hustle black, definitely I grind. So you can try anything you want, I definitely don't mind. Definitely got my ting, I definitely know your face.
None of it's a personal diary in a strict sense. I don't say, today I had got up and I had this to eat and I thought about this girl that don't like me or anything like that. It's not like that. It's more a diary of the imagination, I would say. I do have external things as well, things in it like things I've seen. And that, to me, is what it should be all about. It should be about your life, but not narrowing it down and to the most banal aspects of your life. You have to make it interesting, because there's no point putting it in a public space if you don't want to make it interesting. So there's that as well. But to me, what you should be is talking about things which are making an impact on you on the day-to-day level, and that could be internal things, which is emotions and imagination, and it can be external, which is sense impressions. Those are the two things, and you put that into words. That's what I do.
I asked K-Punk, Geeta Dayal and Simon Reynolds if they thought most music bloggers were frustrated journalists.
I think a lot of blogging comes from a sense of frustration in a way. If you're completely successful and happy in your career, you probably wouldn't feel the need to do that.
In my opinion, I mean, I don't see why any really, like, you know, one of these music bloggers is, they're just as much of a critic as somebody who's writing for, say, you know, Rolling Stone or Spin or whatever, if not more. So I have the highest esteem for these people who are thinking about music on a daily basis, engaging on music at a critical level, trying to come up with multiple connections between different disciplines. And I think this is really where music journalism is seeing its future.
I think people who write for music magazines are quite demoralized. It's all done by email now. Like in the old days, people would hang out at magazines. You know, when I worked for Melody Maker, it was a great place for hanging out, and you'd have intense and humorous discussions in the pub for hours. But if you go to a magazine now, and most people hardly ever do who write for them, they just send in their copy by email. I mean, they're like ghost ships. No one's there. It's just like a sort of the basic editorial staff. There's no vibe, and I think that sort of destroyed the camaraderie that you get with magazines. I mean, you have it with small magazines, like The Wire, I guess, probably has a good sort of camaraderie of the team who make it. But music magazines just seem very lacking in personality and vibe and a sense of camaraderie. and that's resurfaced in the blogs. Ironically, you know, obviously people in blogs aren't meeting up in the flesh, but even so, it's sort of become a kind of community where ideas are thrown back and forth. I mean, people complain about it being incestuous, but it was kind of like that with the old Music Press. They were in joke. You know, as an initial reader of The Enemy, when it was a great paper in the late 70s and early 80s, it was quite fuddling because you sometimes didn't know what all the reference points were and the private jokes that were going on. But eventually you sort of break the code. I mean, the people who wrote for those papers were like real personalities, and that's kind of resurfaced, I think, on the blogs. One of the great things about blogs, or the downsides for some people, is that people weave their responses to music in with their personal lives as well. So it's more humanized, I think.
You're so very fascinating.
So what topics are really igniting this hotbed of discourse? I asked the bloggers to share with me their latest obsessions.
A lot of the larger blogs just sort of function as these engines of discourse, like, say, Simon, when he writes about something, and then immediately you'll see this sort of cascade of, like, 10 other people in their blogs responding to Simon, because Simon has a way of sort of, you know, writing things that might be incredibly controversial to some people, or setting people off, or, you know, and he's got a lot of really interesting ideas about music, obviously, and so you have these sort of larger blogs that I think kind of, in a way, air out these questions, which are immediately developed by all these other blogs. And then you have, one of the things that happens with blogging is that people will get into these massive arguments where, like, you'll see, like, all these different blogs arguing with each other about some topic in music. And you saw that last year with Dizzy Rascal, who's a musician that really dominated blog discourse for so long. In fact, I think The Guardian wrote an article about it. But one of the things that has been really hot in my particular area of the blogosphere recently, especially among people who write about dance music, is that, you know, Simon sort of proclaimed dance music to be dead or whatever, and then immediately all my friends who are dance music writers are like, what are you talking about? You know, Philip Sherburn and Michelangelo Matos and all these other people are like, are you out of, no, this isn't right. And we all, I just covered this big dance music event for the Village Voice where I said, dance music is alive in New York. And so a lot of people were arguing about whether these scenes still exist, whether they're still as vital as they once were. I mean, one of the most exciting things, I think, from a blogging standpoint is when you're able to comment on things from an almost anthropological perspective, where you're actually looking in on different music scenes and you're actually seeing them grow on their own. Whereas with, like, say, with this weekend when I blogged about attending a noise festival for 3 days, it's not something that everybody will go to by choice. So some people will just read what I write about it. And to be able to delve into these scenes and to see these scenes growing in front of your eyes is really exciting. I think that's a subject that sort of dominates blogging discourse to an extent, is where are these scenes? And one of the cool things is that we have music bloggers. Basically, we have foreign correspondents in almost every country. There are people writing in London about music, people in New York, people in San Francisco, people in Melbourne, people all over the globe who are writing about the scenes in their particular countries, who are saying, look, you know, music here is really alive. Look at this great scene that's been starting up here. And I learn a lot from that. And it also is incredibly encouraging to see music growing like that, and to be able to get an eyewitness perspective, a first-person perspective from the front line.
Is there a future? That's the question that I posed on the blog the other day, really. I think there's a kind of paradox of nostalgia that you often get on my site. The late 70s and early 80s, maybe up to 83, I just think it's quite an intense period. I mean, you tend to be formed by things which influence you at the age of 14, 15, 16. That's the age I was in that period. and often kind of hanker back to that, because there's a strong modernist impulse in culture at that time, where there's a very little tolerance for things being endlessly rehashed, gone over. There was a demand for novelty in that period in pop music, you know, in the mainstream pretty much. Since then, there's a general onset of postmodernity as a kind of cultural virus, posing this anything goes temporality, really, where things could come from any time, they can just be rehashed. There's no sense of a kind of forward movement anymore. And essentially the sort of modernist impulse in music came from outside the mainstream and dance music, really. But with Simon at the moment, I'm wondering if even in dance music that modernist impulse is declining, and you're getting a sort of postmodern kind of dance music where it too is now happy to rehash and reconfigure elements of the past. So I think that is probably one of the big debates on the big issues on the site is there a future? Where is it coming from? And a kind of, as I say, paradoxical nostalgia for lost futures, for a time when music and culture in general was pushing forward into the future. Hip-hop is almost like dinosaur rock in the 70s now, in that it enjoys such complete and utter dominance that it's got kind of fat, lazy and complacent, really. Needs to be displaced or re-energised, I suspect.
There's been some debate about the idea of realness, and some people have taken the sort of, I guess, postmodern line that realness, as in hip-hop or whatever, is a construct. It's like a cartoon that doesn't actually have any relation to real life. You know, the sort of gangster postures get exaggerated and become hyper-real and fraudulent, in a sense. And then other people, including myself, have argued that, you know, there is this element of it being exaggerated, but it actually does refer to real things in the real world, you know, real deprivation, real exploitation, real alienation. The sort of main audience for grime or the main audience for hip-hop actually feel, and they're actually, even in this exaggerated form they are, still describing their real conditions of existence, so that you can actually listen to Dizzy Rascal or other grime things, and you actually can learn something about the world and the time we live in. Although it's in a sort of distorted and amplified form, there's a kind of aesthetic impetus to dark and menacing and have the most extravagant threats against other people. But at the same time, it reflects what's going on in London and in those sort of streets. But people, you know, there's still a lot of people who are kind of thinking this dated postmodern way where everything is in scare quotes and everything is mediatized and doesn't actually have any reference to the outside world. I mean, there's been also another debate was about to what extent grime and UK garage was a local music, whether in some weird way it was like almost like a form of folk music. It's very much referencing specific places in the East End of London and specific postal districts get name dropped and local legends, local characters. And, you know, some people, I suppose, understandably find that a bit kind of, they feel excluded if they happen to live in the middle of America or Australia. It kind of, they could get the idea that there's nothing in this music for them because it's such a sort of local thing. So that, you know, that was quite a heated debate. I don't know, it's urgent for the people who participate in the debate. I don't know, it might be of limited interest. I suppose you have to be excited about grime in the first place to care about this question of whether it's, you know, whether the music is addressed to you at all.
I wish that there were more female representation in sort of avant music in general. I mean, I think there are those artists, they're around, they just need to be encouraged. I mean, you know, one sort of genre of music that I've been sort of thinking a lot about is Micro House and the whole sort of German minimal electronic music. I'm heartened to see that there are some women who are breaking through into that scene and who are becoming dance producers and things like that. But yeah, I mean, you have a largely male-dominated area of discourse commenting on a largely male-dominated music form. I went to a three-day-long experimental noise festival this weekend in Brooklyn, which I blogged about, and I was just, the first day I was there, I was just shocked at how few women I saw besides, you know, I was there, and Kim Gordon was there, and Ikoemori was there, you know, but I'm sick of seeing the same sorts of token women brought in all the time. I mean, Kim Gordon is sort of an Ikoemori, so these grand dames of the avant-garde at this point, you know. Where are the new women who are making experimental music? We need to bring them to the fore. Let's push to the future and see who's doing that now. I think that, you know, for me, certainly, seeing women making experimental music at all is very inspiring. It's sort of a feedback cycle. If you don't see women on the front lines, if you don't see women who are writing about music, it's hard to get inspired to do that as well. It's hard to see yourself in that. I certainly think that it's something that needs to be improved, but it's a system that's been in place for a very long time now, and it's something that needs to be, will take a long time to repair.
K-Punk, Simon Reynolds and Geeta Dayal shared their thoughts on the future.
They seem to be really utilising the potential of the internet in a way that hasn't been done quite before. There are clear advantages of the internet over the print medium in that you have no distribution worries at all. As soon as you put it up onto the net, anyone can see it.
Right now I'm writing a book. But when I go back to being a full-time freelance journalist, I'll have a dilemma of my ideas, whether I put them on the blog or whether I try and sell them. There's a good karma element to sort of doing stuff for free and just throwing it out there and kind of not trying to sell it. But at the same time, that's how I make my living. That's how I support my son, who's 4 years old. So obviously, I have to take it by case-by-case basis. The big example that's sort of quite telling in this thing is that one of the reasons I started the blog was I was very enthused by the whole grime sort of scene, what came out of UK Garage with Dizzy Rascal and that kind of stuff. It was hardly being covered at all. You know, if I was just a journalist not doing a book, I would have, you know, sold it as a story or whatever. But I just decided to just totally go off on it in my blog, and because I just had to write about it, and I, you know, there was no money in it, and I mean, there's loads of people who've profited nicely from writing about Dizzy Rascal and that scene. When I go back to being a freelance journalist, I may have to hold the cards closer to my chest in some respects.
I mean, I wonder if this is going to continue in another 5 years. You know, I would pay money to read some of these blogs because they're just so great. I keep telling Matt Ingram, you know, Matt, you should write a book. Just print the whole blog into a book. And I know Marcello Carlin has done this with his blog. He has this Church of Me blog. He actually got a book contract to print out the entire blog and make it into a book. It's quite amazing. I imagine that in another few years, a lot of these bloggers will be getting book contracts who will actually just be putting their blog, you know, on paper.
Sadly, our trip for the blogosphere is over. I would suggest, though, you make your own minds up by having a look online. Or better still, you start your own blog. Everything you need is at www.blogger.com. If you'd like to contact me about this programme, email mags@resonancefm.com or click on the links at www.youarehere.co.uk. That's youareheare.